business partners, Agrifab Incorporated, Sullivan, Anderson Foundation, Body Works Associates, Champaign, and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, providing trophies, plaques, and awards for sports teams, business teams, and many others. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. We go to the archives for our interview segment in the 1 o'clock hour today. Celeste talked with journalist Brooke Kroger back then about a new book called Passing: When People Can't Be Who They Are. This is a tape-recorded program, so please no calls this afternoon.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Passing. When we hear the word, we're likely to think of it in very negative terms, a lie, a betrayal. Recall the melodrama Imitation of Life, Fanny Hurst's novel, and the film adaptations of that novel. We may also see passing as anachronistic, a thing of the past. But is it? Well, think about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then there is the new film, The Human Stain, about a black man, a professor of classics who has passed for white and Jewish and is forced from his position for an allegedly racist remark. The film, based on the Philip Roth novel of 2000, is set in 1998. Journalist and biographer Brooke Kroger is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. It was her biography of Fanny Hurst that led her to her latest book project, a book of research on passing. The book is Passing: When People Can't Be Who They Are. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. If you'd like to participate, give us a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Brooke Kroger is the author of the biographies Nellie Bly, Daredevil, Reporter, Feminist, and Fanny, The Talent for Success of Writer Fanny Hurst. She is an associate professor of journalism at New York University. She has also worked as a foreign correspondent and editor. Her new book, Passing: When People Can't Be Who They Are, is published by Public Affairs. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Brooke Kroger, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
What led you to write that biography of Fanny Hurst?
Well, as you just said, it was, the biography of Fanny Hurst
yeah.
in the first place?
Well, yeah.
That's a different story. Let me answer that.
Go back a little bit further here.
Let's go back. I wrote the biography of Nellie Bly, who is a legendary American journalism figure, one of the first women to really be writ large on the journalistic stage, whose dates were 1864 to 1922. And in researching her life, and of course this was a case of someone who was very dead and gone, and nothing was around, and all there were very, very fictionalized, thin, juvenile biography legends. I really had to excavate her story and find documentation where none existed. There was no archive. There was nothing. And in doing so, I was very struck by the fact that women had accomplished so much in the years between 1880, let's say, and 1922, and every important issue for women today had been dissected and understood long, long ago. And then somehow, as someone who came of age in the 70s, it was stunning to me how we thought we were blazing new trails, when, of course, everything had been done years and years and years and years before. But, of course, because of the absence of a written record of women's history and other reasons, there was no mark. You know, we simply thought we were blazing trails that already had been very well trod. So I thought it would be very interesting to find a subject like Nellie, who is what I call a second-tier subject. This is not someone who's a genius or someone who has, you know, invented the atom bomb or done something of extraordinary proportions, but rather someone who is a figure of mass or popular culture, who then intersects with everyone of her era and every important thing going on, though she or he himself or herself is not really the primary subject in that sense, on the world stage, but is very important in their own way because they're so famous and they're so well known and everyone seeks their company. So I looked for someone very much like Nellie who could take the next period, who would go from around 1900 in their adult life to 1968. And I literally did it by going through the obituaries in the New York Times to see who made the front page, what woman made the front page in 1966 or 1968. And, of course, there was a bare handful. One was Lurline Wallace, who had been George Wallace's wife and became governor of Alabama. One was Lisa Meitner, who had been instrumental in the discovery of the atom bomb. And another was this woman I had never heard of named Fanny Hurst. Mm. And then as I went back to and thinking, oh, my goodness, what did she do to get a front-page obituary in the New York Times and a full-page inside and an appreciation on the editorial page? I mean, imagine the impact she had and yet a completely lost legacy. I think largely for the reasons Nellie Bly was lost, which was no family to perpetuate the memory in large part. So anyway, in doing her life, and I used that to look at what had happened, you know, where did the amnesia come from?
Yeah.
When women had done so much by 1922. And of course, my conclusion was in ferreting out Fanny Hurst's life that it came largely after the war. It was about women leaving the workforce, going back home to recreate the family, to save the family, to heal and nurture their men. And in so doing, in this very, very short period of about 10 to 12 years until, you know, The Feminine Mystique was written in about, I think, 62 or 63, it all was forgotten. You know, in just, it doesn't take a generation. It's sort of interesting how everything was, like, blotted out and began again. So that was the reason for the book. It's a rather long answer for that, but
yeah.
That was why. I wanted to tell that story. And she was perfect because she intersected with everyone. She was very involved with the Harlem Renaissance, though she was white. She was a Judith Krantz-like, you know, schmaltzy novelist. She, all her films were made into movies. She was enormously financially successful. I mean, was getting $6,000 a short story in 1928. So, for me, she was a perfect figure to trace what women were doing in that period.
Yeah, and in her later years, apparently, she was quite outspoken.
She was always outspoken.
Yeah,
she was always outspoken.
Yeah, yeah.
There were over, you know, 300 stories about her in the New York Times from 1910 on, till she died.
Well, her novel that later was made into two films, one in the 30s and then again in the 50s.
That's right. Well, the novel was written in 32, filmed almost immediately, but it came out in 34 and then again in 59.
Yeah. Imitation of Life. How was it received when it appeared, when that novel first appeared?
The novel?
Yeah.
The novel actually appeared originally as a magazine serial in a magazine called Pictorial Review over four issues, and it was called Sugar House. And there was a huge debate about the title, and they finally came out with Imitation of Life for the book, which, of course, was obviously a better title, a legendary title. And the short story was received well enough. It was another Fanny Hurst vehicle, the usual $5,000 advance, the usual $50,000 movie sale. It was just her usual story, and she was churning things out at an alarming rate for a very, very long time before this and for a good while afterwards. Very successfully. I mean, very, very successfully, in ways it's hard to imagine now, considering how forgotten she is. And Imitation of Life was a work she was not proud of. And one of the things I discovered in writing the biography is that she began writing the story immediately after a road trip with her friend Thora Neale Hurston. And one of Fanny Hurst's techniques in coming up with her fictional enterprises was to take a snapshot, something she'd seen in life, and then work from the snapshot, supplying her own narrative around the characters. And this, of course, is a little bit of conjecture, but I can very well imagine Zora and Fanny, you know, did they ride side by side in 1932 on their trip to Niagara Falls from New York City?
Mm.
One wonders. And if Fanny might not have said to herself, here are two friends, one black, one white, making a trip through what was still a very segregated world, and from there, you know, from the snapshot of that trip, because the trajectory of time is so obvious, there's no way this wasn't an inspiration. And to come up with a story idea that then turned into Imitation of Life. Naturally, it's not based on Zora at all, but you can see her moving from that trip, and they were gone for 10 days, almost 2 weeks, to concoct this kind of a fictional narrative. So received, of course, the movie was fantastically well received. Louise Beaver, had it not been impossible for a black person at that time to receive an Academy Award nomination, certainly would have. I believe the film was nominated for an Academy Award, the film itself. There was a lot of material in the press of the time saying that Louise Beaver's had been robbed. But, of course, it was unthinkable in 1934, unthinkable.
Yeah. I haven't seen that adaptation, but I have seen the later one.
And, this is the Claudette Colbert version.
Right, that's the early one.
The early one, yes.
And then many years ago on television I saw Imitation of Life, the one that was made in the 50s.
The Lana Turner one.
Right.
Which is the Douglas Sirk version, which right. is better known.
Right. And the power of the story, you know, lies in the heartbreak.
Lies in the heartbreak. And I think, you know, as I started to write about it, to write this book, I realized that, you know, I think, as a young girl seeing this film and weeping, as so many of us did, I think up until as recently as 1996, it still was appearing on lists of the favorite movies of all times. It has this incredible power, both for African-American and non-African-American audiences. It's just such a powerful story of breaking the mother's heart, et cetera. And the tendency, of course, is to blame the Piola figure, you know, the Sarah Jane mm-hmm. figure in the later version. You know, how could you do this to your mother? How could you do this? And yet, of course, with growth and learning, you start to understand that the real villain in this story is racism. And if we didn't get that the first two times we saw the movie, the first few times, we certainly get it now. And I think that, in many ways, was the impetus for this book. I have no doubt about it. I started to ask myself, my goodness, this is such a dated idea. Who would do this now? You know, what possible
right.
reason would anyone have for passing post-1970? You know, I mean, how is that even imaginable? This is some old relic of a time we have certainly moved beyond. And then I said, or is it? You know, I kept thinking, I mean, originally we had a conference at Princeton, which I worked on with Nell Painter, who was the chair of African American Studies at Princeton at the time, and we started with the premise of, could you remake this movie? You know, could there be a third remake, and what would it be about? And, you know, the best idea I could come up with was illegal immigrants or something. It just seemed preposterous to imagine this as a black-white story. And then, of course, Philip Roth clearly has found a way in some ways, I mean, though not to compare the films, but or the novels, certainly not a comparison of skill, but of course, the way he did it, Roth, which was very clever, was to set the story in 1998, but it's really about someone who began passing in the 1940s, when, of course, black for white passing was something that was quite understandable. I did, however, find a black for white passing subject as well as a white for black.
Right.
A little bit different, but not so different.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about David Matthews.
Okay.
He began presenting himself as white in elementary school. How did it all begin?
Well, he looked white. Let's start with that. He was in a, as he describes it, as a Huxtable-like neighborhood. And this is very much, I think it's important to emphasize, a coming-of-age story. You know, this is someone who was coming to terms with his own identity, as a young person does. And the passing does stop when he gets to just beyond college. I mean, there's a point at which he really does elect to embrace his entire background for a number of good reasons. But in these early formative years, where his own sense of cultural aspiration and taste very much was akin to the Jewish children he knew, who he also looked like. And so he said, as anyone in a school setting, you gravitate to those people who embrace you and who think of you as like them, which was exactly what was happening. The extreme irony in his story is that he is the son of a white Jewish mother and an African-American father who's very, very light-skinned, and generations of very light-skinned people in the family. And his mother, however, separated from the family when David was a very, very, very tiny infant. So he did not know her at all. He did not even know her name until he took his driver's test at age 19 and saw his birth certificate on the way downtown. Mm. So he had no Jewish background whatsoever, though, of course, under Jewish stricture, he's as Jewish as you can be. He's the child of a Jewish mother, which is really all that's required.
Right.
And so, that's, you know, it's kind of an interesting lie because it really wasn't a lie. And yet, of course, his father, being this very prominent African-American civil rights activist, editor of the Afro-American in Baltimore, active in Sergeant Shriver's War on Poverty, you know, a real player on a large screen. He was, as a reporter, one of the only two reporters to be in the room with Castro and Malcolm X at the St. Teresa in Harlem when they had that historic meeting in 1960. So he was, you know, very, very involved with his own culture. And yet here was David with this ambiguous appearance, trying to get by in a world in Baltimore, a very segregated city at the time, and I think still to some extent, very, you know, demarcated in terms of race, where you had to be on one side or the other. It wasn't like you could switch lunch tables. It was not an option. And the things that interested him, his own cultural tastes, were very much like these other children. So he's, you know, wily enough and smart enough to understand that the information about his African-American-ness was going to get in the way in some ways in the 1980s in Baltimore in a group of Jewish friends. And because school was not near home, it was like a magnet school, you know, where people came from all over, he simply never brought anyone home. And when the question would arise, usually at the homes of these white parents saying, oh my goodness, what interesting features, where are you from, what's your background? And he would say, I'm Jewish. And they would say, where do you go to Temple? And he would say, we're not affiliated. And they would say, what does your father do? And he would say, he's a journalist. He said, of course, I didn't have the courage to say he's the editor for the Afro-American. Mm-hmm. That he couldn't bring himself to say, which embarrasses him now.
Yeah.
There were other instances working in Baltimore as a, you know, 16, 17-year-old, working in a restaurant to earn extra money, where, you know, having been hired and working for a while, it suddenly quickly became very clear that all of the bus staff were people of color and the wait staff were white. And he had, of course, been hired as wait staff, and it was pretty clear to him that this was an error. And, of course, he did not mention it. He passed in the most traditional form we know. And one young busser seemed to know someone who knew his father or knew a friend of a friend and called him on it and said, David, are you sure you're not black? Because blah, 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 blah. And David immediately said, I don't know what you're talking about. And, of course, this is something that shames him greatly now.
Yeah.
But in that setting and in that instant, it seemed like, here's my choice, and this is how he would talk about it. Either my life is a social agenda struggle, or I simply finesse these things that are getting in my way for reasons that really do not make any sense. Why do I have to live out of this person's idiocy on this subject?
Yeah. On the other hand, if you were a person on the bus staff, it wouldn't be, you know, it's not a question, David, of you can't be who you are. You can be who you are, and you must be who you are.
Very true. I've noticed, I've had, because of the human stain, I've had lots and lots of conversations with many audiences over the last several weeks on this topic, and it's very clear that in many, many conversations with African Americans, there is huge hostility to the idea of passing for exactly the reason that you raise, and quite understandably so. And I've debated this back and forth with people a few times. If you take the example of the film of The Human Stain, for instance, you know, there's a scene in the movie where he breaks, where the young Coleman Silk Blake breaks his mother's heart by telling her that he will pass all the way and he will not tell his bride about his family and he will not bring her home and he will not bring grandchildren home, and it's devastating to the Anna Deavere Smith character who plays the mother. And, you know, it's a scene just like the scenes from Imitation of Life that make you feel exactly the same way. And yet if you step back from the sentiment of those moments, which are certainly important, and the idea of denying a heritage, of not embracing a heritage, of assimilating into another culture, of not bringing back to your people, especially an oppressed people, is very hard to put a stamp of approval on. I think there's little question about that. However, in making the decision that, let's just take the fictional example, in making the decision, and I don't think this is true of David's case, but let's take the more serious example. Coleman Silk, as dean of faculty at, you know, fictitious Athena College, Lily White, Eastern Establishment College, liberal arts, you know, privileged liberal arts college, was able to bring on African-American faculty for the first time, which is something everybody seems to overlook. He was able to affect change on not necessarily a better or a bigger stage, but on a different stage. And maybe it's one story at a time. And I think we can stipulate that he would not have been a classics professor at this particular college in the 1940s. He would not have had the opportunity to become dean of faculty. None of those things would have probably occurred. You know, they might have, but it would be highly unusual given the time and place. So, yes, it's horrible what he did to his family, but on another historic stage, is that not valid? Do we negate that entirely? I don't know. I mean, I think it's an open question, and I think that's perhaps something that can be asked of these situations. David got to be the waiter. The bus staff did not, but one of the things we know about passing historically is that people in the African-American community do not have a tradition of giving up the passer, even when they're very, very clear about who the passer is. And this has been repeated to me many times recently, that we can always tell. You know, everybody always knows who's passing. And the tradition is not to give the person up. And this has been explained by Adrian Piper and others as being for several good reasons. One is that you don't give up a fellow traveler, someone who's making their way through an oppressed life as you are. Two, you don't. You might enjoy seeing someone have something over on someone who deserves to have it over on them because of their attitudes, their unconscionable attitudes. You think they've suffered enough for the breaking of ties to root community and family. And there might be a fourth reason, but those are three of the important ones. So for me, passing is a very complicated subject, and I mean, it's just not easy to have a pat answer about. And I didn't start with this because I started with the posture everyone starts with, and the one you very well explained so well in your introduction. But in talking to these various people, and not just the black for white and white for black subject, but also the gay for straight subjects and the class passing subjects and the others of the six stories that I examine in depth, I came to be persuaded that maybe there was another way to look at this, and that you could actually go so far as to see it as another instrument in helping bring about social change. Certainly not the only one. It's for the special team, and it's not for the impatient, but it does serve a purpose, because when you are creating change, you have to agitate loudly from outside, and you have to work more subtly from inside, and this is one of the tools for doing that.
Yeah. In that sense, do you think passing might be seen as an intimate form, a very personal form of civil disobedience?
I mean, that was someone, one of my subjects, one of my sort of ancillary subjects, actually a rabbi, a dean of a seminary in the gay story, suggested that idea, and I tested it with some important philosophers, and everyone seems convinced that you cannot call it a form of civil disobedience because it is not public.
Right.
Its very covert nature makes it not civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is a public speech. It's a public protest. It's a rally. It always takes the form of something loud, vocal, straightforward, never subtle. So that wouldn't be a correct definition. But you could see it as a cousin, you know, like sort of a distant second cousin, might be a way to talk about it. But certainly a form of social action, you know, if not civil disobedience in the classic, you know, Rawls definition.
Yeah. So once the mask falls, we really see whether it is taken off deliberately and one reveals oneself, or whether it is somehow, whether you're outed.
Well, it's in the outing that it becomes clear. I mean, as Werner Soller says, you know, in an act of passing once revealed, we can see passers as ideal questioners of the status quo. Where are we now? So we watch a story like Coleman Silks, and we know that, let's say, in the story, the passing had been revealed publicly. Let's say at his funeral, his sister had gotten up to speak, you know, and said, "I am his sister." And there would have been a gasp, but nothing really would have changed in the way it would have pre-1967, let's say. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, so we know that we've made progress. We know that things are different than they would have been. The reaction to learning about an exposed act of passing is one of wonder, surprise, gossip, but no one's going to jail for it. No one's being expelled. No one's being, you know, sent into exile. I mean, nothing like that is happening in those very traditional tragic mulatto narratives of the 30s and 40s. So that's a place where we can see where we've advanced. But you hear a story like, you know, a don't ask, don't tell story from the Navy or the Army of someone caught in a gay passing incident. And this is a case where, of course, the passing is enforced. I mean, it's required. I mean, it's stated. It's mm-hmm. not even a covert act. It's a requirement for a gay person. You can come, but you can't talk about it. And think how excruciating that must be. And I was made very present to this through the two gay stories I include, one of a young man who passes through Jewish Theological Seminary, which is the conservative movement seminary where they have not yet permitted, I shouldn't say not yet, but they do not permit gay ordination, though it is now being debated again for the first time in a decade. And the other is someone in the military who was passing in the military before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and all through Don't Ask, Don't Tell until her retirement several years ago. And in those cases, it just is so painful to think of how, and I, not being gay, I'd never really thought about this before, but heterosexuals, of course, are talking about their sexuality all the time. They put pictures of their loved ones on their desk. They talk about their vacations. They talk about loved ones when they're ill. You know, they make arrangements not to go to work to go help someone who's sick. They do all sorts of things that tell you about the intimate details of their lives. And, of course, a gay person in those situations, all of that is foreclosed. They can't do any of that. So at every turn in the normal discourse of daily life, they have to put on this mask all the time, which has got to be extremely painful. And I think the military is a really good example of this because of the fact that the passing is required. You know, it isn't an election. Well, I mean, you have the election not to be in the military, I suppose. But if it's, you know, there's a wish to serve your country, it's a tradition in your family, all of the reasons someone might want to have a military career or even for the opportunities and advantages it involves.
Yeah.
Imagine what that must be like. I mean, in some ways, it's the most pristine example because it's required.
Yeah, although it would also be required of Joel Alter if he was going to stay in the conservative movement.
That's right. And his case is wonderful. It's so nice that you really know the story. It makes this conversation so great. His case, too, I mean, the difference being, yes, he could have gone to the Reform movement, he could have gone to the Reconstructionist movement, but this was a young man very, very steeped in this tradition. This is his tradition. This was his family life. This is the life of all his five siblings. I believe it's four siblings. This is something he sought to do from childhood. It was a vocational calling. He's a deeply spiritual person and wonderful and someone who, you know, people, I mean, it's interesting that since the book has come out, people who know him or know members of his family have called me and said, "I never knew that about Joel." And of course, he was the poster boy for the seminary. You know, he was exactly that. I mean, the definition clearly holds. So someone like this, who's going to be denied a privilege or a possibility where he really will be in a position to give back to his community in the most fundamental way possible, a community that he sees in need of this kind of leadership that he felt, you know, born to provide, would have been denied. And I think that's another way to talk about passing, as a way to get through periods of transition. In his mind, at the time of which he made the election to pass through 5 years of seminary, I try to imagine what this must be like in a religious community, a tight, small religious community where everyone is living in the dorm. I mean, it just must have been incredibly difficult. That in his mind, when he did it, he was first of all coming to terms with his own sexuality. It was a new thing to him in terms of really dealing with it, and it wasn't finalized in his own mind, but it had clearly presented itself as a real and probable scenario. That he foresaw a time because of the ordination of women, which had happened a decade before. This is like around 1992 or so. That he foresaw a time where the movement would make this decision within his lifetime. So what do you do? Do you forego the possibility of answering your calling, your vocational calling in the, you know, most fundamental sense of that word? Or do you just get by? You know, do you find a way to get by and hope it's all going to turn out all right on the other end?
Yeah.
And as he talked about his story, he said, every single day for 5 years, I had to stop at some point or another and say to myself, what am I doing? This is crazy.
Yeah.
And yet, in the end, it seems to have come out all right.
Yeah. Another person who said, this is crazy, Victoria Sanchez.
Vivian Sanchez.
Vivian,
yeah.
I'm sorry. The potential for harm and hurt in her life was so significant. She walked in several worlds.
She walked in many worlds. And again, I think her story, very much like David Matthews, is a coming-of-age story to a large extent. This was someone, you know, very much grappling with who I am and where do I fit in, which would not be the case with Joel, and it was not the case with my Navy careerist. It's certainly not their case. They knew exactly who they were. You know, very, very different scenario. Even though it was happening at roughly the same time, same age, you know, time. But they were not grappling with that. They were simply trying to get through a thicket, you know, that shouldn't have been there, and that they were clear shouldn't have been there. In these cases, these were younger people trying to find a place that they fit. So here was Vivian, who grew up in a housing project in New York City. When she was 4 or 5, the family moved to a little town, middle town outside of New York City, about 80 miles away. To a little house, but very impoverished, and yet she was a very gifted student, the only gifted student of her background, which happened to be Puerto Rican, though, interestingly, she always talks about it as Spanish, and which tells you something else. Anyway, so in classes, she'd hope to have friends among her gifted classmates, and of course, was socially very rejected, though she was a very good student. And so she made friends with a very tough group of kids who happened to also be minorities and would live this bifurcated life, you know, sort of stealing hubcaps at night and getting into street fights and being on National Honor Society by day. She was able to obtain a scholarship to a college in Poughkeepsie, and she said it was in going to college that she realized how really poor the family was, because she, even with the scholarship, she didn't have money for books. So everything was such a struggle. And after a semester, she dropped out. The idea of loans was very upsetting to her, and it was simply too difficult to live two lives. She still had a boyfriend, holdover boyfriend from high school, so she was traveling to Kingston by bus every weekend for $5 and breaking into cars to steal food, you know, to get money for food, and then coming back to be a presidential scholar on Monday. So this was... I think of her story very much as a class-passing story, you know, trying to find a place to fit. She goes on. She becomes a secretary. She does other things. And I don't want to give away all the stories, but she discovers Orthodox Judaism at a certain point, of all things, and immerses in a serious Orthodox conversion. And I think Judaism represented many things for her. I think that she grew up in Middletown is a community surrounded by some Hasidic communities, so it was something she had at least a visual familiarity with. She certainly knew Jewish kids from her public school in Middletown, and they were all often very privileged, something she aspired to. And I think as she became immersed in Orthodox Judaism and, you know, the focus on learning and study was very inviting to her, and remember, she dropped out of college, so there was a need to have this intellectual component in her life, and it was a place where she could compete on equal ground, where no one was questioning her university credentials, you know, to be able to argue a piece of Talmud or whatever. So I think this was extremely important to her because it was so intellectually alive and spiritually alive, because she always considered herself a very spiritual person. And then, of course, she moves to the Upper West Side of New York City, which is a community full of young Orthodox, very young modern Orthodox Jews, and moves in to room with two girls who, of course, show her no favor. You know, they just kind of take her as a roommate and don't befriend her. And even people who did befriend her were constantly saying, "Sanchez, what kind of name is that? Where did you go to yeshiva? What's your background?" And constantly having to explain herself, that at some point she just kind of fell into deciding to be Sephardic. You know, and when they'd say, "Oh, Adiah," which was the Hebrew name she took, "Why such an unusual name?" And she, "Oh, my parents wanted to be original." She's, "Imagine I'm, you know, coming up with a story about how my parents gave me this Hebrew name," et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of this was simply not to have to keep dealing with explaining herself as other, as different, in a community where that should also not have been happening. But did.
Brooke Kroeger is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her new book, Passing, When People Can't Be Who They Are. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. By the way, Brooke Kroeger, our guest, has a website that you can visit, and you can learn more about her book, Passing. It is brookekroeger.com, brookekroeger.com. There is a story in the book that is amazing and sad, a story of a woman who accidentally finds herself passing, inadvertently passing as Black. And it seems to me she's still sorting it out. At least she was by the time you had finished writing that chapter of the book.
Still sorting it out.
Yeah.
I've tried to get her to go on the radio, and she just will not. It's just too painful for her, which is so interesting because it's been so many years, and it's an incident totally forgotten in the place in which it took place, which reveals a lot. She's a very thoughtful woman.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that story in a minute, but let's talk with a listener first. Caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a fascinating topic, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the title of that movie, The Human Stain.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it yet, but I do plan to go. But I think, without knowing what the author intended by that title, I think it sums up why people pass. You know, it's like, white America has been obsessed with purity, racial purity, morals, all kinds of things. And people of color were seen as a stain on the American culture and American population. But at the same time, there's this fascination with the culture that people of color produce, such as blues and jazz and salsa and, you know, all these things that are exotic to white people. Do you address that in your book about the whole idea of people pass because they're not, you know, the whole idea of America seeing itself as so pure and people wanting to pass as pure and get away from the dirty side of American life or something?
Well, I do cite some of the historical instances where this came out. And, of course, you know, as several of the columnists who've written, I mean, Clarence Page's column in the Tribune a couple of days ago addressed this too, how much the old one-drop rule still governs the way we think about race.
Right.
And that's not over.
Mm-hmm.
And even in listening to African-American audiences, I've been struck by, you know, when Wentworth Miller, the young man who plays the young Coleman Silk in the movie, who is a child like my subject of a white mother and an African-American father, and is very light-skinned, but identifies totally as African-American. And that was also the expectation of the audience, that he doesn't have a choice about that.
Mm.
And that's a place where I think that's fine, but, I mean, it's not mine to judge anyway, but it's where we see that identity also comes from the outside as much as it comes from the inside. You know, it's always what's being ascribed to you by the culture.
Right, right.
You have to own up to your biggest stigma. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's our system.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
if you're in Kansas and you're two Methodists, you know, white Methodists meeting on the street, nobody has to talk about white or Methodist. But if you're, you know, just about anything else,
mm-hmm.
you're almost obliged to bring up your background if it isn't apparent on your person, because, you know, what's the reason for that? Well, maybe so we don't say something inappropriate. Maybe it's because we have to categorize people. We have to be able to put everybody in a little box. So those things they tell us about their identity are what we have to categorize them, to understand them. And, of course, passing has a way of upending all the tidy little ways we have of organizing human beings,
mm-hmm.
which are completely inappropriate. Now, of course, what you bring up is also true. I mean, one of the great things about having cultures that haven't assimilated, that do stay rich, is that they produce these wonderful cultural forms that
mm-hmm.
we all enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I guess as you dilute cultures, I guess maybe the best stays and the rest falls away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows what our life will look like 500 years from now? It's hard to imagine. W.E.B. Du Bois said something that I have quoted several times because I find it so fascinating. And this was back in 1929 when Nella Larsen wrote her novel called Passing. And it was a Harlem Renaissance story of a very light-skinned black woman who marries white, passes completely, but then is drawn back to her root culture and so keeps making forays back to Harlem. And she's a person of no moral fiber at all, so she, you know, just messes with everybody's life and ultimately has a tragic end, as you would expect. Anyway, in writing a review of that novel back in 1929 in the crisis, he was so prescient. You know, he starts by saying, passing, of course, in our day, meaning 1929, is a matter of great moral import. But I can foresee a time when another audience in another generation looking at this subject would think that, would have a hard time even understanding what people were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like that it was something that was of absolutely no importance. A petty, silly matter of absolutely no importance. I believe those are his exact words. And, of course, what we know is we're not there yet because we're all sitting here talking about passing and talking
right,
about race.
Right, right.
So we know it's not over, even though we'd like to think so. We'd
mm-hmm.
like to think, oh, my goodness, we're beyond all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But there are just too many signs that we're not. And I think when you look at passing seriously, both in terms of racial passing or gay passing or anything else, you can really see where the society stands on the subject. It
mm-hmm.
immediately becomes clear in how we react to learning about such a story.
Yeah.
So it's useful to us. It
yeah.
remains useful
yeah.
to everyone else. You know, I don't know about the passer, but to us, certainly.
Right. Toni Morrison once said that racism will go away when it's no longer useful. You know, it seems to rear its ugly head when the society needs it. You know?
So true.
And
one of the things they say about passing is, of course, when there's no more prejudice, there won't be any passing.
Right, right.
That'll be gone.
Right, right.
So guess what? It's not gone.
Right.
There we are.
Well, thanks very much. I
thank you very much.
Book.
Very lovely.
Thanks
okay,
for the
bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Back to the idea of the exotic. I think that holds for the story of the woman who found herself inadvertently passing as black. She was on the one hand drawn. She had a black boyfriend. She was drawn to him, and
not just to him, but to everyone surrounding him,
right.
to his world, to his universe, to his people. I mean,
right.
she was very, very drawn.
Yeah.
And this was in the late 80s.
Yeah.
So it was adventurous in the time. She was from a small town. She went to a very small southern town to teach and was teaching in a mixed school that was predominantly African-American and did a lot of great things for the school, was only there on a one-year contract, as young teachers often are. And there was an incident where she was invited to be the MC for a charity fashion show, and it obviously was a great honor. And the story, I don't really want to give up everything, but
yeah,
the story plays out from there. And she ends up, first of all, inadvertently passing and realizing that she has been passing to the people who've been watching. Because, of course, passing isn't always a conscious act. And traditionally, African-American passing, as in David's case, starts with people presuming you're something other than what you understand yourself to be. So you see that you can pass, and then the decision comes, okay, will I or will I not? But that was her case, and then she had to decide what to do about it, and that's the more interesting part of the story.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, but to do that, what I'd like to do is go back to Vivian's story and David's story. What allowed them to take the parts of their lives and sew them together to create a whole?
Disclosure. Irving Goffman talks about this, that you get to the post-passing state of grace, as he expresses it, which I thought was so marvelous. Mm-hmm. And it's the time at which you disclose fully. My gay subjects, for instance, I know you weren't asking about them, but they disclose. Vivian discloses. David embraces his African-American heritage. His father was getting older. His father, he considers a national treasure. He did not want to not have a portion of that which was rightfully his. And he put that together. She put that together and came to terms with their whole selves. And as I said, that's what Irving Goffman would call the post-passing state of grace.
Mm. Well, I'm sorry we don't have more time.
I can't believe that went so fast.
It's amazing, isn't it? Brooke Kroeger, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're very welcome. I hope it was helpful.
Brooke Kroeger is the author of Passing: When People Can't Be Who They Are. The book is published by Public Affairs. You'll also find her on the web at brookekroeger.com. BrookeKroeger.com.
And that interview was from last November on the Afternoon Magazine. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices are now in from the Chicago Board of Trade. With those numbers, AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom. From the Chicago Board of Trade, a good day in the wheat and the corn pits. If you're looking on the upside of the marketplace, anywhere between 4 and 7 cents higher in the corn. The wheat was up 9 to 10 cents in those two nearby. The wheat was up 9 to 10 in those two nearby contracts. The beans not rallying nearly as much today. Most of it said to be some speculative buying before tomorrow morning's release of the prospective plantings and the quarterly ending quarterly stocks report, the grain stocks report as of March the 1st. We'll get to those numbers and a complete look at what those figures might look like in the current terms of estimates when we talk to Wayne Nelson this afternoon. At 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. Now, from the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat to high today at 416 and 3 quarters, a low at 407, a settlement price there at 415 and a quarter. They finished the day 9.5 higher. July futures, 421 to high, the low at 411.5, a settlement price at 402 and a quarter, and they finished up 10 cents. September wheat, 423.5 the high, the low at 413.5, a settlement price there, 422.5, up 8.5 cents. December contract in the wheat pit, 432 the high, the low at 420.5, settlement price 431 and a quarter, up 9.5 cents. And the March futures, 431.5 the high, the low at 424, settlement price at 431.5, 8 higher. May corn futures, 312 and 3 quarters the high, the low at 306 and a quarter. A settlement price there, up 7 and a quarter cents in the nearby May contract at 312 and a quarter on the settlement. July futures, 317 and a half high, low at 310 and a half, a settlement up on their high or close to it, 317 and 1 quarter, up a 7.5 cents. September futures, 311 and a half the high, the low at 306, settlement price at 311 and a quarter, they finished 6 higher. December corn now, 307 and a half the high, the low at 301 and a quarter. A settlement price at 306 and 3 quarters, and they finished 6 higher for the day. March futures, 309 and a quarter the high, the low at 304 and a half. And a settlement at 308 and 3 quarters, they finished 5 higher. And the May contract, 310 the high, the low at 306 and a half. The May 05 corn settled 309 and a half, up 4 cents. July futures for next year, 309 and 3 quarters the high, the low at 306 and a half. And the settlement price at 309.5, up 4 for the day. And the December 05, this is 2 years out, 269 the high, the low at 266. A settlement price for the December corn for 05, 267, up half a cent. May oats, 172 and 3 quarters the high, the low at 169. A settlement price at 172, up 3 and a quarter. And the July, 177.5 high, low at 174. Settlement price there at 177, they were up 4 on the day. From the bean pit, futures and May contract, 10.24 the high, the low at 10.12. Settlement price at 10.16 and a quarter. They finished the day 3.25 higher. July futures for the beans, 10.13 and a half high, low at 10.03 and a half. A settlement price at 10.08. They finished up 4.25. August on out finished the day lower. The nearby, the August contract, which would still be an old crop, 972 the high, the low at 961, a settlement price at 962, a penny and a half lower. September's 858 and a half high, low at 849, settlement price at 850 and a half, down 3. And November futures, 765 and a half high, low at 755, a settlement price there at 757 and a half, down 6.25. January soybeans, 764 the high, the low at 755, a settlement price at 755, down 6 cents. And the March futures in the bean pit, 755 the high, the low at 744, settlement price at 749. They finished the day a nickel lower. May soybean meal at 317 on the high, the low at 314.20, settlement price at 316.50. They finished 2 higher on the day. In July bean meal, 313.90 the high, the low at 310.90, settlement price at 313.60, up 270 for the day. May bean oil, 34.17 the high, the low at 33.05, and a settlement price at 33.11, down 28. July futures in the oil, 33.95 the high, the low at 33, even a settlement price at 33.01, and they finished down 26. Now, here's Tom Rogers with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
All right, thanks, Todd. Looks like an up day in the cattle. The hogs, though, mixed to lower. Our settlements for today in March feeder cattle, the high 90.70, the low 90.62.5, settled at the low 90.62.5, still up 15 over yesterday's close. April live cattle, or feeder cattle rather, at a high of 89.75, the low 89.25, settled at 89.72.5, up 72.5. And the May had a high of 87.90, the low 87.40, settled at 87.47.5, up 35. The August feeder cattle contract had a high of 88.47.5, the low 88.05, settled at 88.10. That was unchanged on the day. April live cattle, the high today 79.90, the low 78.10, the settlement 79.82.5, that was up 205 today. June live cattle, the high 72.60, the low 74 or 76.20 rather, the low 74.60, settled at 76.15, up 185. August live cattle, 75.15 the high, the low 74.40, settled at 74.90, up 57.5. And October live cattle, 76.90 the high, 76.52.5 the low, settled at 76.67.5, up 20. April lean hogs had a high today of 67.95, the low 67.20, settled 67.80, down 32.5. The May, 68.80 the high, the low 68.10, 68.57.5 today, settlement down 12.5. June lean hogs, 74.80 the high, the low 73.35, settled 74.65, up 87.5. And July had a high of 70.20, the low 69.35, settled at 70.20, the high up 5. March pork bellies, the high 113 even, the low 109 even, settled at 109 even, down 100. May bellies, the high 108.72.5, 105.50, the low settled at 108.20, up 92.5. And those are the closing settlements.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
A barnyard question from Greg McVary, San Francisco, California.